You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello there, I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and this is episode 12 featuring Noel Britton, a wonderful comedian who is either on the verge of retirement or has already retired. We'll be talking about that in the show. Lots to talk about today. I say that every time, but it's true. No more so than in this one, which was such a long and fascinating conversation that we've got about 40 minutes worth of extras. Hang around till the very end, then I'll tell you where you can pick up the extra material. But for now, here's Noel Britton.
And, but we were talking about the difficulty of starting without going, so how did you get into it? Now,
yes.
I know how you got into it, because right. you're a street performer. So let me chuck, or you were a street performer, and still yeah. perform the walk.
The walk, yeah.
Bath walk. We'll go into that in a little while. I once heard it said, and I know that the Covent Garden rumour mill, the street right. performing rumour mill, is can sometimes right, be simply yes. that. But let's start by me throwing this at you, because I think you're an incredible writer. I think you've, in terms of a rolling laugh from an audience where they can't even pause to breathe because you've got everything, and I mean that in terms of your audience interaction as well, where right. you know everything anyone could possibly say, and you've got all sorts of responses covered. Plus, I mean, I've no idea how many of them are improvised, right. but you look like you're improvising well on top of what I assume are stock responses. So. Given that you are that good, and I've seen you be that good, I could well believe the
why are you describing the Covent Garden as
the following. I heard this at Covent Garden, and because I think you're this good, I could well believe it. This is the line. Apparently, you are responsible for writing most of street performing, because that you were the only person, or one of the very few people in Covent Garden back in the 80s when it was dangerous, who was sitting down and writing jokes. And everyone came to Covent Garden and nicked those jokes, and they became generic, by which I mean more than two people stole them.
Right.
And thus, in much the same way as I've heard Alex Dandridge invented the concept of getting the kid to throw you three objects up to your unicycle,
right.
I've heard from more than one source that you are largely responsible for street performing as we know it.
Right.
Disgust.
Well, that's bollocks, obviously. So I'll get that straight out of the way. I wrote a lot of lines on the street that got
can you give me some examples?
Because
I am sure I've stolen some of your lines over the years without knowing whose they were.
This is when I'm terrible at this, but there was some hat lines. I mean, the other thing that I do an awful lot of is I write toppers and stuff like that.
Yes.
So it's that thing of going, okay, well, you've got that as a basic line, but now you've got three or four extra bits on the top and
sure.
stuff like that. So street performing is such a long time ago. There were some hat lines that I quite like, just the psychology of, there was a bit where just as you bring the hat out, you go, oh, hang on a second, everyone stare at that man walking away, like mm-hmm. you know, because mm-hmm. someone always away now, everyone boo that man, everyone hiss that man, everyone spit at that man. Okay, and because they obviously boo, and
sure,
they
hit, sure,
the
sure.
spitting obviously doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But there was a sort of psychological element of that of, oh fuck, I can't walk away now because he's obviously
because aware, we've all seen
because,
someone.
Because, yes, he's actually aware that people do walk away, and he's quite happy to point
yeah.
them out.
Yeah.
But oh god, there are so many elements in this. But the thing that I always find with a show and stuff like that is there are the jokes, which is obviously the core element, but then there are also things that you need to tell people just on a instructional point of view, or you know, that you're going to be collecting money and what you're expecting and stuff like that.
Sure.
Now, if you've got to give them some instructional information, the best way to give that is as a joke.
Yes.
Rather than just saying, oh God, now I'm breaking out of it and I'm giving you information.
Of
so,
course. Yeah, yeah.
So, this the thing that the street performing grew into, which is a sort of guided walk around Bath, which uses street theatre around the city. Mm-hmm. There are bits where I've got to get the crowd across the road.
Yeah.
And basically you've got to warn them that you're crossing the road and there's cars coming in the other direction, yeah, to the ones they might be expecting and all that sort of business. Now, each one of those is now a gag, the information that's in there.
Gotcha.
So
okay,
anything that, theoretically, anything that I say in the walk,
yes,
is going to be funny. It's either funny in itself or it's a backup to a gag of information that I need to give.
Okay. So you're taking all the individual bits of information and instruction,
yes,
and making them all funny.
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you do that, theoretically, there's no dead time.
Yes.
So that's how I'd sort of always, yeah, see it. So
sure.
So a lot of the street stuff was the hatting lines and crowd gathering lines and stuff like that. But I mean,
I wanted you to say, well, I first wrote Fold It Up, Drop It In.
No, you know, but there's a very interesting story about that, which is gets down to the writing thing and stuff like that. There are two people that I always refer to. There's a guy called Reverend Chumley, who
okay,
used to work in America as a street performer, very old, sort of grizzled hippie guy that I worked with at the Vancouver Comedy Festival when I was street performing. And he sort of hang out with the Karamazov brothers,
okay,
and that sort of Avner, and, you know, when they were all doing street stuff. So, I mean, a long, long time ago. So, no, I go and see a street show, and it's very funny. He's doing quite sort of different stuff,
mm-hmm,
to what everyone else. I mean, he did like a key bending routine and stuff like that, which you just sort of go, oh, I've never seen anyone on the street.
Thing,
no,
okay,
you know. So, but quite quirky stuff. And he does the whole, and it's got some very funny lines in it and stuff like that. He's very engaging and warm and stuff like that. And does all, and, you know, you just think, God, this is all original stuff. This is absolutely mm-hmm brilliant. And he gets to the end of it and he goes, so I'll be taking a collection. And kids, if your mum or dad don't give you $5 to give to the funny street performer, it means they don't really love you.
Yeah.
Like that. And I just go up to him at the end and go, I said, you must have written that. There's no way that you would do a completely original act
and then tack on
and then
mummy
have
and
on some hack line at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And because he was this grizzled hippie,
yeah,
who'd obviously been doing it since the 60s, he sort of went, yeah, I think I did write that one. Well, I mean, was so drug-addled brain that he couldn't actually remember. But, you know, you sort of go, oh, well, that's... That he must have.
There's a reasonable chance he did. Someone
because,
did.
Yeah, someone must have done. And also the fact that everything was so original and quirky. And, you know, you go, well, that did. In the same way that I saw a guy then a couple of years later on a TV talent show doing, you know, as a sort of mainstream comic doing a set. And every single act, every single joke or line in his act I'd heard before and, you know, could pretty much know who it came from and stuff like that. And he finished off with one tagline at the end,
yeah,
which was really funny,
yeah,
but I've never heard before.
Okay.
And you immediately go, well, whose is that?
Yes, of course.
Not oh, that's brilliant that he wrote that, because you go, well,
yes, and he's not written any of it.
If he's not written any of it, the chance of him writing one line of it is pretty slim. No, I mean, that's the thing with anything that generic or, you know, well, everyone uses it. Like you said with Chumley, it was that thing of like, well, someone must have written that
someone
line originally, and
yeah,
the first person who took it,
yeah,
you know, we're stealing it, but then once it gets to a certain level, it's like, well, everyone's using it, isn't it? And, you know, and coming from a variety background myself, as opposed to a straight stand-up background,
mm-hmm,
not just street, but just generally magic and special acts and that type of thing, that is much more... well, accepted is the wrong word. It's just sort of more... It's more part of the history of it and stuff,
yes,
like that, you know, in that tricks are sold and...
But this is it. I often think of magicians seeing performance as modular.
Yes.
Like, you get this module. You get the module which you buy from a shop.
Yeah.
It comes with a piece of paper that says, do this patter.
Yeah.
And it's some hoary old patter. But
yes,
you kind of get it and can judge it up.
Yeah.
But it's the same basis. People almost sell the jokes with the tricks.
Yes.
And so I think often, and there's a lot of, there's a few interesting, innovative magicians working on the comedy circuit at the moment.
Right.
People like Ali Cook and Pete Furman.
Sure.
Who are writing their own tricks and creating their own tricks. But there's, I wonder if that's the point at which you need to break through from magic to the comedy circuit, is you've got, I mean, I have seen people do generic patter on the comedy circuit, and to comedians it stands out like a sore thumb.
Right.
And to the audience they go, this guy's incredible.
Yes, yeah.
He's performing the best of magic.
Yes, yeah. You know? Well, and to an extent, you're very much hampered by the fact that you're limited by the props and what you can actually talk about while you're doing doing.
Yeah.
You know, if you're, you know, and it's the same problem that jugglers have. If you're juggling three clubs,
yes,
you're going to talk about the clubs, and that's relevant.
To,
yeah, you know, there are not many people who can actually. There was a magician, big hero of mine called Bob Reed, who did a card trick where he was doing completely non sequitur patter to what he was doing. I mean, it was literally just a monologue of one-liner gags. Had nothing to do with the cards changing design in his hands as he was showing them to you and stuff like that. So that was different. But a lot of the time, you're constrained by what you're using, and therefore it's sort of easier to justify stealing regular routines, because you go, you know, so I mean, there's a very standard bit with a bit of rope when you're going to cut the rope in half, where you go, well, it's a piece of rope with, you know, two ends in the centre. Well, if I cut off one of the ends, it's now only got one end. If I cut off the other end, it's got no ends. And if I cut the middle, it's got no ends and no middle. And then you put the rope back together again. Now, that's all sort of justifying cutting it and putting it back together again.
Yes, yes, yes. That's an instructional element.
And you sort of go, oh, God, right, well, that's an easy thing to say while I'm doing a cut and restored rope routine, you know. So a lot of it is being hampered by the props. A lot of it's being hampered by the, again, coming from a special background, there's what I call the ta-da moment of in every trick you've always got the business of, and that's your card and the rope's back together again and your notes in my wallet and all those things, which actually will always elicit, hopefully, some sort of reaction,
sure,
regardless. So it's everything's building up to that, so even if you're not funny, you've got that safety net of well, I juggled three clubs on a 6-foot unicycle or whatever. And it's difficult once you've got the ta-da moments as part of your rhythm and part of your, you know, how you think and stuff like that, to then go, oh my God, now I'm just talking without actually anything at the end that I know is going to get something.
So is that why you, do you think that's why your act, your stand-up act, is so punchline heavy, because the punchlines are your ta-da moments, and you're driven by that instinct to get from one explosive release to another.
I think part of it, but also like this, you know, like you're saying, well, how do you, you know, why do you ask, well, how do you get started in magic? And like we were saying before we started the interview, it because that creates so much of what your mindset is and stuff like that. So very briefly, when I was a kid, my grandfather was a member of the magic circle, just as a hobbyist. He showed me a few tricks when I was a kid. I was quite shy as a child, you know, usual shyness thing and all that business. That made me a bit different at school. I could do these little, oh, that's quite interesting. Yeah. He showed me this. He used to get a magic magazine sent to him every month, sort of like trade.
Yeah.
You know, in the days when magazines used to be sent as subscription things. And there were two, most of it was tricks and, you know, ideas and stuff like that. But there were two people who used to write a monthly article in this magazine. One of whom was called Billy McComb, and one of whom was called George Johnston, one based in England, one based in America. And all they were talking, and their monthly article was what they'd been doing in the last month, sort of shows and anecdotes. And they were just all these brilliant stories. It was just, you know, and neither of them were particularly famous or as household names. They were just good jobbing acts.
Okay.
So Billy was doing cruises, and I mean, you know, Billy was, you know, was very, very good. Worked at the Palladium and you know, Royal Variety shows and stuff like that. So he was a good magician, but not a household name or anything like that. But he was just doing all these, oh, you go, this sounds brilliant. You know, he's off on a cruise this week, and then he'd have his photos of the pyramids and meeting other magicians that, you know, he said, I saw this other magician working on the quayside doing some sort of street performing thing. And George Johnson was doing all these sort of, banquet shows in America, sort of corporate-y type things, and working with all these big names as just a very sort of solid act, support act in a variety bill, or, you know, headlining in Las Vegas. You know, they'd always have a magician or juggler or comedian, whatever, on, you know, before the sort of headline spot. So they all work with really big people. And I was just going, that's brilliant. That's what I want to do.
Yeah.
I just want to do this. What they're doing of swanning around and, you know,
see the
sounds
world,
brilliant. See the world, swan
meet
around.
Meet great people.
Yeah. Have these, you know, great stories about working, every, you know, panto and circus and cruises and everywhere. So, and they were, you know, this was probably in the 70s, I guess. So they were talking about working with Bob Hope and Jack Benny and people like that. So then I started reading those biographies and all those people that I was reading about and whose autobiographies I read and were very sort of gag-packed autobiographies, like George Burns, Jack Benny, Bob Hope, Joan Rivers, are all very one-liner orientated.
Yes.
So okay. I was, you know, so that sort of...
Programmed already. Like,
what you do. This is what you, these, you know. So that was sort of one element of, oh, right, I want a very rapid laugh rate. And then I was working at Hamley's just after I left school selling magic. It was...
that's a classic introduction.
Absolutely.
I think Mickey Flanagan's nephew worked at the, you know, the little magic stand in Covent Garden.
Right, yes.
North Hall.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can see people go there, oh, I turned up. And then once you're working at the magic stand, you see people doing shows and you go, hang on a second, I can do this over there. That's the conveyor belt, exactly.
So I was doing that, and that was the time that Paul Daniels was just doing his first West End run, and he'd just come to prominence. He'd maybe had one TV series on at that stage, so you're talking, you know, really early 80s. And he went into the West End for a month's run leading up to Christmas and ended up staying there for 14 months.
Okay.
He did a 14-month run. Jeez. In the West End, as you know, well, I was saying a one-man show, but he had other acts in the, you know, special acts in the show. So I went to see it a couple of times, well, probably maybe three or four times over the course of the year, because I was working just down the road. And he was really hungry in those days, you know, just out of the clubs. No one had really seen anyone do this sort of mixing magic and, you know, patter before. And
really?
Yeah.
Was Daniels one of the exponents
in terms of being the sort of cheeky chappy and actually being quite digging at people, you know, as opposed to, the guys before that had been like David Nixon and Robert Harbin, which was all very sort of gentlemanly and, gotcha. Could I possibly borrow a cigarette off you and all this business, and Daniels is going, well, have you got a note, you know, give us a note.
Yeah.
I'd give him a £10 and he'd rip it in half and give them back. You know, that's a stupid thing to do, wasn't it? You know, just ask you. No, so it was that. It was much. It was that undercurrent of like.
Okay.
More.
That's so interesting. The way that the alternative becomes the mainstream.
Yeah, no,
to
absolutely.
To think that at some point Paul Daniels
was
kid.
Yeah, yeah, and also in those days, you know, I mean, and part of it was, you know, he was hungry and had a lot to prove in those days. You know, because oh my God, this is my big chance and everything like that. He was incredibly quick on stage. I mean, at one stage he'd have five people on stage and he'd go, what's your name, what do you do for a living? He'd have a gag for every name. He'd have a gag for every living, every profession. And you sort of go, okay, well, that's just a question of sitting down and going, okay, right, plumber, if I get a plumber, I'm going to say this. And
we'll get
someone who works with aircraft, I'll say this.
Yeah.
But then on, while they're up on stage, he's going, the two of you should get together.
Because if
you did that, and you're going, what? That's bloody hell, that's not written.
Yes,
that's
great.
That's him thinking on his feet and stuff like that. So, you know, and really impressively fast and funny and, you know, a great, really great show. So, and he'd come into Hamlet occasionally because he was, you know, had a matinee and an evening show. So he'd wander down and have a chat and stuff like that. And I'd say, well, how do you get to be funny.
Yeah.
You know, because up until that stage, I've read all these George Burns books and they've got gags in there, but, you know, I was sort of half aware that they had writers, but I sort of thought most of it surely was coming from them and stuff. So he said, well, what you do is you read a load of comedy and you get the rhythm in your head of what comedy is. You know, if you're just reading it all the time. And he recommended me this American writer who was who wrote monologues and gags for magicians and stand-up comedians in the 1950s, 1960s, and put them out as books. So, I mean, it was actual monologue of
just
light.
Just one liner
right after another.
Okay.
And just hundreds of them, like that. And they're from the 50s and the 60s, so a lot of them are dated. Yeah. You know, you're going, I don't even know what product you're talking about, because it was also topical stuff. And he was incredibly prolific, this guy. So I'd read all these books, and you sort of go, oh, actually, now I see it. Without reading a book on how to write comedy, a sort of, you know, Jean Perret book or something like that, yes. It's that thing of going, you sort of go, oh, well, actually, I realise now that there's just that rhythm. And if someone said something, you sort of go, oh, well, the natural thing to make it funny is add that on as the second half of the sentence.
So your equivalent of running upstairs and fighting chickens?
Yes.
Was reading books. Was you reading hundreds of one-liners?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And, you know, there's an element of a lot of them were so old they were new again because people have forgotten about them. So you just go, well, fuck it, I'm not letting anyone say that for a while. I'll use that as a heckle stopper, absolutely. Loads of it, like I say, because it was dated, there were loads of Edsel gags. Do you remember that? Edsel? So Edsel was a car that came out in the 50s in America, which was just a disaster. I mean, it was this huge marketing flop. For a very funny reason, if you look it up on the internet. But anyway, so it was this huge marketing flop, and there were all these gags about, you know, Edsel cars.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's called Edsel. I'm doubting myself now, but yeah, I'm sure it was called the Edsel. And they were terrible cars. So there were all these lines about having terrible. Now, in the 80s, that was Larders and Skodas, you know. So you sort of go, well, actually, this now is an old gag format, but is now relevant again, and because everything is cyclical with politics and wars and religion and stuff like that. A lot of that stuff you could sort of go, oh, well, actually, yeah, you know, even if it wasn't relevant exactly as a one-liner in that form, you sort of go, oh, actually, the underlying current of that theme of that gag,
the formula
is still good, or the topic is still good, or the link between X and Y that's happening at the moment is good. So it needs a new gag, but that's a valid link, or it's a valid formula, but I need to find something to put that formula to now.
Okay.
So, but consequently, Robert Orban was all very much one-liner. So that was another, you know, plug in the memory of, okay, that's what you do, is you do one-liners.
So thanks for downloading today's episode. This is a really interesting chat with Noel. If you've not seen his act, I hope it's not too late for you to try and track him down somewhere. He is still working, unusual gigs here and there, odds and sods, things that he really wants to do. You're unlikely, I think, now to see him in any of the commercial comedy clubs. But this is a really interesting chat. Noel has a unique position in that he straddles the worlds of magic and street performing, as well as stand-up, and also runs, as you'll hear, a unique comedy walk in the city of Bath, where he lives. And we're going to be focusing on a lot of very specific things maybe that we haven't touched on before in the podcast. We're going to be talking about having a certain act and honing it over years, tending a relatively small garden, but I can never make the garden metaphor work, but the point is, he has a certain amount of material that he's very well known for, and rather than going up to Edinburgh and generating new material all the time, he spent a large part of a very long career, 15 years plus, working on that same material. So we'll be talking about the differences of what it means as a comic to work in that older style, I suppose, that you don't see so often. We're going to be talking about the nature of retirement, about happiness, as ever, about playing the game by your own rules. But also, we're going to talk. There is some stuff here about street performing. Some of it in the main show, as well as the extras, and some of that is about the nature of generic material. We talk a bit about Covent Garden and the similarities that the model of Covent Garden has with the comedy circuit in terms of the development and the renewal of talent. I think that's a really interesting theory that Noel has on that. We talk a little bit about bottling a crowd, which some of you will know means asking for money after a show. And obviously that has a lot of links with the Free Fringe, so that might be of interest. And also we'll be talking about working support for a larger act and how one deals with fame. Noel, again, has got some really fascinating theories on fame and what exactly it is people are looking for, certainly when he seems to regard himself as a jobbing act rather than a wannabe famous act. So that's all of that. There's another little fun thing, which might be nice. In collaboration with Danny McLaughlin and Dan Nightingale, an erstwhile collaboration, I've decided to start a thing with the podcast called New Hack, where you can send in your examples of things that you are sick to the back teeth of seeing on the comedy circuit. Things not old hack, not you play this venue twice in your career, once on the way up, once on the way down, which isn't so much hack, to be fair. It's a bad example. That's more like a classic joke. But I'm talking about the sorts of things you hear up and down the country by new comedians, such as saying strap in or buckle up every tenth sentence, or boom, things that in the mouth of the writer of that material could have been something really exciting and interesting, but which now has just become a very commonplace, cliched thing to say. So that's New Hack. Hopefully we're going to have comedianscomedian.com/newhack up and running very soon. But for now, do email me, info@comedianscomedian.com, or put it on the Facebook group with your suggestions, and we will create, I don't know, either a game of bingo, maybe doing bingo with to spot things is hack itself, who knows. But I think you'll see this sort of thing I mean. So please send those in. That should be quite fun. Hopefully we can kill it stone dead. So a separate download, which of course will be at comedianscomedian.com/Noel, with extra material about Noel's walk and his street show career, tips on what you're going to do if you're doing cruise gigs, and also some horror stories there. And the origin of some specific gags in Noel's set. We're going to talk through some of those in detail. You can support this podcast in a couple of ways. You're unable to do so financially at the moment, although I'm hoping that will change. But you can certainly support the podcast if you like it by passing it on, talking about it, telling people about it who you think might enjoy it. Feel free to tweet it with reference at compod. With reference? Who says that? This is a terrible thing I've noticed I'm doing. Whenever I'm on Twitter, I write in a tweet and then I hit return as if that's going to send it. Makes me feel very old. Do tell people on Twitter about the show. Our Twitter feed is at comcompod. info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to send me an email with suggestions for the show, recommendations for people you'd like to see on the show, for guests. And also you can join the Facebook group, which is facebook.com/comedianscomedian. So I think that's all the blurb I need to tell you. Very last thing before we go back to Noel, is if you are interested in being on the show, if you're a comedian and you'd like to be on the show, then remember, please don't simply come up to me and say, hey, can I be on your podcast? Because that makes me think you don't listen to it. So if you would like to be on the show, feel free to tweet, text, or speak to me backstage at a gig sometime and simply say this sentence to me: I'd be very pleased to be introduced to your beautiful daughter. That's the code for now. We'll see if that works over time. Now, back to Noel Britton.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
And then came to Bath to go to university, started street performing while I was here, and consequently that was the street act as a, you know, right, I'm just going to get as many gags in there as possible.
And were you doing magic on the street? Was that the skill element?
So yeah, it was a sort of cod magic trick, puppet routine, escapology thing.
Did you do and, It's a Boy?
Sorry,
did you do It's a Boy during the escapology thing?
No.
Just for the benefit of our,
standard.
The Josser or whatever, the non-carny among you. The It's a Boy is an incredibly standard line performed by escapology escape artists, when they've got the crook of their elbow just coming over their face when they're removing a straitjacket, and so their face is being pushed out of this sort of orifice between their chest and elbow to go, "It's a boy." And it invariably is a boy.
Very few girls. Yeah.
But that's a classic kind of, that's almost like a module with the straitjacket. And I always think the class of a straitjacket act is predicated on the fact that they don't use that, right, yes. Because no one knows it. It's a definitely huge laugh, but you'll know that everyone watching you who's in the know will know that you're an It's a Boy person.
Yes.
Yeah.
But then from that, you do go into this thing of like, well, who are you doing it for? Are you doing it for the audience? Are you doing it for other performers or yourself? Or what is it that you're... And again, that all comes back to what your mindset is and why why you've got into something in the first place. So, you know, you can look at someone on TV and go, God, I'd love to be, you know, having all those people staring at you and be that rich and...
Yes, okay.
You know, now that's a...
That's
one way of doing it. Yeah. And if that's what your goal is and that's what your underlying thinking is, then that's the way that you'll act to progress through the career, and that's what you're those the elements that you're looking for. Whereas if you come from a different mindset, you're looking for different things and stuff like that.
I should say as well, I think I probably throughout my street performing career, which was about sort of 10 years or so on and off, I probably was guilty of picking and choosing the stuff I was prepared to do that was generic.
Yes.
There's certainly stuff I did that I felt like, oh, this is how it's done.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think my excuse at the time would have been, not as a non-magic performer, I was a juggler and a, you know, quasi-tightrope, quasi-acrobatic person, very, very quasi. I think my excuse at the time or my mindset would have been, street performing is so difficult. To go out in Chester on a Wednesday afternoon and try to get a crowd to stay, I felt like, look, anything goes. I'm just going to go for anything. And then once I can maintain a crowd, once I can get an edge and hold it, then I'll, you know, try to give back as much as I've taken out.
Right.
You know, which I might have done in some sort of things. So I feel it. I'm just saying. I'm picking on It's a Boy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No. I mean, no. I think there are elements with that, and there are elements of that with stand up and stuff like that. You know, I mean, that there are sort of, you know, as hack lines as empty tables on the front row and, you know, it's the camouflage unit in or the apathy society or any of those lines that you sort of go, well, those are as hack on the circuit as It's a Boy.
Yes.
In just that thing of like, oh, well, that's the situation. That's the line that covers that situation. Now, you could try and think up a new line.
Yep.
Or you could just go, oh, fuck it.
And I suppose when you're a new comic, simply learning that is the line that's said feels like an achievement.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw this guy get stuck like this before, so I'll do that and get out of it like he did.
Yeah.
And I do think it's often through comparing or it's occasionally comparing because that has sometimes the most problems to solve. Maybe it's through problem solving that you go, there's an issue here. Like, that's why the street performing money lines are often very generic.
Right,
because you're solving the problem of making them pay.
Yeah.
If you're comparing, then heckle put-downs are the most, you know, that's a problem that you often have to solve. So there is an element of grasping, and then you try other things.
I mean, like on the street at one stage, I was trying this thing desperately because I thought, well, theoretically, my hatting line was sort of based on the fact that the reason that you could walk away right now, you know, I mean, I've done the show, you can walk away, there's no reason why you should give me money. All I want you to think is, have you enjoyed the show? Because if you have enjoyed, the reason I've been able to afford to do this show this time is because people in the past have given me money.
Yes.
Now, if you've enjoyed the show and you'd like other people to enjoy it in the future...
Wonderful.
Now,
wonderful!
But not a single laugh in it, obviously. No. You're just going, this is a sort of slightly philosophical...
Sure.
You know, aren't we making the world a better place?
It's effectively the live your dream speech.
Absolutely. And then 2 weeks later, I'm going back to, I know which one's more profitable, fold it up and put it in.
Yes, sure.
You know, and you sort of go, well, you tried it for a while and...
Yeah.
And then, well, why am I doing it? Well, I'm doing it for the money because I've still got to eat and
this
stuff
is,
like that.
So. This is it's very current, actually, very relevant to the Free Fringe at the Edinburgh Festival. I don't know when the last time was you went up to Edinburgh. Or...
I did once in 1999, so yeah.
Okay, well, it's unrecognisable from then.
Right, yeah.
But now that Peter Buckley Hill's Free Fringe and then the Free Festival as well have become a thing, they now exist. And so people are taking very new acts, often acts that are so new they haven't got a good 20, taking an hour up there because it doesn't cost them anything.
It hasn't changed that much.
Well, but myself and a guy who you might know, Pete Dobbing, who's a good friend of mine, also a kind of new act and a street performer, you know, a very good street performer who started around the same time as I did. We've been giving almost workshops. I cannot stop myself from telling people how to ask for money at the end of a free fringe.
Right, yeah.
And there are certain things that you should...
Need to say, yes, yeah.
Exactly, like certain key elements, which I'm not going to give away on the podcast, but maybe, you know...
You're running your own workshop in a couple of
weeks. Well, exactly, yeah, exactly. You want to give away.
Money well spent.
Well, we should be, because it's... But that is one of the... That's an element I haven't ever considered, which is a really good... It's almost the epic sweep, the place in history. There should be a name for the bottling line when you try to convince the audience. And the thing is, it's true. It is true what you say. The reason you can do it now is because people enjoyed it before. But reminding people that they are part of some broader church.
Yes.
Isn't this life itself? Yes. That kind of angle.
But there are no laughs.
No, exactly.
And on the street... Yeah. Nah, comedy is king, so yeah. that's what gets the money out of people. Yeah. So the filtering thing, the other thing I was going to say about that was that this business of people seeing it and go, oh, that's what you've got to do. Because the other thing, I never worked Covent Garden. I've done one show in Covent Garden, but everything else was in, if I was in England, it was Bath or York or a couple of other places in England. But
I did one day in York, I did three shows.
Right.
And I was so pleased that Steve Faulkner told me beforehand, no one turns up, they hate it. In the last 5 minutes, you've got a massive crowd they all pay.
Yeah.
If he hadn't told me that, I'd never have finished a single show.
No. Well, each pitch does have its own...
Yeah.
What's the word? Sort of, you know, you're built by your environment and stuff like that. So, I mean, you can still see... I mean, English acts definitely have a very different style to American acts and Australian acts. But even within England, you could sort of go, oh, well, that's definitely a Covent Garden act and that's more of a...
Yes.
Bath or York or Stratford act or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah.
But what was interesting... So when I went to Covent Garden the first few times in the 80s when it just opened and there were street performers there, you went there and there are all these, like, really different acts. Like, there was the Vicious Boys and Pookie Snackenberger and the Popticians and Captain J.J. Waller and all these really eclectic different acts that had sort of... Because this new venue had come up, were all coming with their own little thing that they were into.
Sure.
And then it was sort of time that Channel 4 was starting, so Channel 4 went down, oh, these are great. Oh, these are the sort of people we want for presenters because they're a bit anarchic and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, Angelo Abella from the Vicious Boys got taken out the circuit and Luke from Pookie Snackenberger sort of developed Stomp and stuff like that. So he was off the circuit. So there were these acts being creamed off the top,
mm-hmm.
which now meant there was more space for... So new acts came in,
yeah.
but they're not quite sure what to do. So they look at the acts that are there already and go, oh, this is what we're... This is the sort
this
of thing...
This is how it's done.
This is how it works.
Yeah.
And then the next year, a bit more gets taken off the top, which are usually the ones that are doing something slightly different because otherwise it's just like, well, this all looks exactly the same. So the different ones get taken out each time, the ones that are quirky and have got something different to offer. So you end up with it getting more and more homogenised, where eventually you're just going... You turn up there... And you look at a Covent Garden act and you go, you know, you watch three or four Covent Garden acts now, to an extent, or Cups and Balls acts, you know, with Gazzo leading the way and stuff like that, and Cellini. And suddenly you go, well, that's it.
That's the same thing.
That is what you did. Not, oh, can I do something different that might be, you know, quirky or whatever. It's just, oh, well, that's the formula.
Presumably, when you get something where everything is very similar, maybe that's then the breeding ground for people to go, I've got to do something different to this.
Yes, playing devil's advocate, the only thing I'd say with that is you've only got to do something slightly different. So you're never going to be anarchic. It's just going to be, oh, this looks slightly different to what the other people are doing, yes, because yes, everyone's doing exactly the same thing. And I think stand-up is
I was going to say that, to bring that back to the stand-up circuit. There is, from the heyday of alternative comedy in the 80s with people doing wildly different things, as someone who's been on the circuit for a very long time, you must have seen stand-up go through those...
process
as well.
And I'm going to sound like, you know, Mr. Old Curmudgeon now and stuff like that. Because, I mean, I was quite old when I got into doing stand-up, because I'd been doing The Street and then set up this other thing, the comedy tour thing. So the stand-up was sort of last step in it. So I'm 48 now. I'm acting exactly like mainstream comics acted when I was younger, where I'm going, this isn't funny.
Yeah, okay.
This isn't what comedy is. But there's no jokes in this. It's all just lots of performance and lots of, whichever way around it is, all style and no substance, or the other way around. You know, and I'm just going, I don't get it. It's not I'm saying it's wrong or it's not comedy, because obviously they're still entertaining a huge audience of people.
Sure.
But I'm standing there going, I don't get this. And if you're following someone who's just done that and the audience has been pissing themselves,
yes,
there's a slight element of like, well, is this what they want? Is this still that? Because I'm still giving it, you know, Mr. you know, one-liners and stuff like that. And most of the time, you know, it goes fine and stuff like that. And it's all great. But you just sort of go, oh, well, is this... You know, is it moving on and it's a younger audience? And, you know, it's certainly a different audience to...
And a differently trained audience as well now. People expect something different from comedy clubs now. Do you think? With the amount of stand-up there is on TV that's...
I really don't know. I mean, like, you know, I don't feel that I do stand-up anymore now. I feel I've sort of retired from it. I mean, I've just... from the circuit, certainly... I mean, I've got
still available for private work.
Still available for private work. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know, there are one or two things that I've, you know, I go, oh, actually, I'd still be interested in doing this or that. But overall, I've sort of stopped doing it for various reasons.
You were talking about your. There are various reasons. As my first retiree,
right,
amongst my interview subjects,
yeah,
the various reasons for your retirement. One being that you feel less connected to what it is that circuit audiences want. Would you say that's the case? That, I mean, even if you're watching someone who's like a young guy, and the whipping boy image of the circuit now is Tony Law's concept of a young boy in a t-shirt noticing things,
right?
Which is, that's, you know, that's kind of. Like lots of product in the hair,
yes,
skinny jeans, telling a story about something funny that happened to their friend and saying it was the funniest thing ever.
Yes.
There's a lot of that around.
Yes.
So is it that you see people laughing at that and you think, how can this audience possibly like what I'm doing? Or is it more that you... I mean, is there a sense of... I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is there a sense of disdain?
There were various nails in the coffin.
Okay, go on.
Over the course of several years. So that's one of them. Secondly, there's a feeling of I've sort of done what I want to do.
Yes. I mean, you seem like a happy retiree. You've not given up.
Oh God, no.
Gone, right, I've completed it.
And with the walk thing that I do, I mean, I've been doing that longer than I've been doing stand up,
sure,
and I'm still doing that, and I'm still enjoying that. Sure. So that I find interesting. So it's not like, oh, I'm not funny anymore, I've lost my passion about comedy or whatever. You just go, I don't like that particular venue and environment to perform in anymore. Now, one of that was the travel and all that side of it, and I was in the sort of Jongleurs Glee Club circuit when those were three or four nights a week.
Mm-hmm.
you know, and that was going away to somewhere for 3 or 4 nights and being able to drive there or take the train there and then sort of decamp into a hotel room. Yes. And
You're on with people you like.
And hopefully you're on with people that you like. Not always, but hopefully you're on with people that you like. You know, and that was sort of... But now it's gone down to, you know, sort of 2 nights maximum, and most people are only, most places are only 1 night.
You just Friday to get this is, left, right.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you're going, this is an awful lot of driving and travelling to do what? To do what I already know that I... Mm-hmm. Well, either can do or used to be able to do. So the travelling cycle, that all got me down. You know, in relation to petrol prices going up and traffic getting worse and the gigs not going up and stuff like that. So there's that element. There was a slight element of losing passion about it. I mean, I remember doing a show at Battersea Jonglers, flatlined, absolute silence, apart from the occasional stomach rumbling, and everyone else did fine, so it's not like, oh, it's the audience or whatever. It's, it's definitely, they just didn't buy into me. And I remember driving home thinking, God, a few years ago, I would have bloody taken that as a challenge and tried to turn it. I would have done anything.
Yes.
To just go, right, fuck it, I'm gonna get you in all this business. I thought, no, fuck it, I know this should work.
Yep.
The app works. Yeah. 99% of the time, gets good reaction, you know. So, you know, it's a blip, you know.
Sure.
Fuck it.
Sure.
Not worried about it, sure. You know. So I drive away. But it was in my mind of like, God, that's sort of losing the passion about it slightly.
Well, is it?
Not the passion, but maybe just the... You're just getting a bit... You've done it for a long time.
You've got
more realistic about it or whatever. Absolutely, but it's a change of mindset. Sure. From
sure.
You know what it's like.
I'm going to show them. You know.
Yeah, yeah. And then when you get to clubs and there's some open spot who is skinny jeans and hair product.
Yeah.
Where it means so much to them and they're so, you know, yes. and you're just sitting there going, oh, there was that program on TV tonight. I really wanted to see that. You know, I mean, you just go, oh, am I becoming, you know. Yeah. Bitter old pro or whatever. So that was an element of the Battersea one. And the other slight theory I've got, and I know the theory is a bit wanky, but if you're doing stand-up all the time and you're an act that's part of a 3-act bill or whatever, two, three-act bill, I think there's an element after a few years... You might not have got there yet.
Go on. I'm trying to guess. I
certainly have.
I'm trying to walk out what you're going to say.
Where you think, actually, it wouldn't matter if I was here or someone else was here. If they swap me now at the last minute, you know, and Jonglers used to. I mean, Jonglers would suddenly go, oh, can you not do Leicester? Can you do Nottingham?
Sure,
can you
swap around? That's
you know, there was no one picketing the building with, like, you know, where's Noel Britton? Exactly, yeah. You know. You sort of go, you're just a bit of a commodity within that club circuit environment, which is why everyone wants to, not everyone, but a lot of people are, you know, clamouring to be, I want to do my own thing and
sure,
be a star and tour and everything like that. Now, I think to a smaller element than that is people going up to Edinburgh. Mm-hmm. You're going, well, I could be working a club during August with 350 people in it who... actually don't know who the fuck I am and wouldn't care if I was there or not, and probably actually if the disco started half an hour earlier might be might be even happier than me being there. Or I could go up to Edinburgh and have 6 people sitting in the audience least those 6 people have said, I want to see Charlie Farnes Barnes, and I'm gonna spend my money to come and see you for an hour. And that is ego with a small e sort of gratification thing of like, oh, you know, I'm feeling justified with what I'm doing. Now, with me, an awful lot of that comes through the comedy tour thing the walk thing that I do in Bath.
So one of the things that I try and focus on in the podcast is about how people write. So let's use the walk to get into that. If you talk about the walk is kind of a set now, isn't it? It does have magical elements to it, but it's effectively a script. Have you ever written it down?
No.
Has it always just come about through improvisation and then...
It was sort of a bit like the stand-up, scripted in the... and again, this, you see, it always comes back to this mindset thing. You see, with Billy McComb and George Johnson, it was within them talking about doing these all these various jobs that they were doing, you just got the impression that this, all they were working towards was this very honed 20 minutes or 40 minutes or whatever it was. I mean, Billy, bless him, had sort of 3.5 hours of material, because he did the cruise ships all the time and they needed that much material. Mm-hmm. But it was always very much about honing stuff as opposed to, oh, I'm going to try something new. And myself and an American act that I know very well always going, God, you realise we were born about 50 years too late. You know, if we'd been in that different environment when that was what you were meant to do, you know, we'd be...
Maybe lights.
We'd be the accepted form or seen as not successful, but seen as, you know, as opposed to, you know, I know on the circuit that people would look at me and go, God, he's done exactly the same 20 minutes for 12, 15 years or whatever it is, you know. How can he possibly live with himself? What does he think he's doing? Oh, for God's sake, you know, in the same way that I've stood at the back of clubs when another act's been on who I sort of saw as non-changing but professionally as reliable as myself in terms of audience reaction and stuff like that, going, sure. God, I mean, this is... And that was... And I love that process. I love that thing of like, oh, God, how do you just tweak that line a bit more, and is that a slightly longer pause and...
Yes.
You know, and how do
there's
you...
a whole world in there, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
no,
like,
absolutely.
It's like being... You can tend one garden and you can tend that one garden for 40 years, or you can go out and plant shrubs all over the place. I don't know where this is going, but you see my point.
I've just been tending the one plant. That's right. I mean, I'd dream of a garden. So, so that is sort of... And I was writing stuff, but I just put it in notebooks and stuff like that. I mean, I just sort of... And again, this is a mindset thing that I always talk to people about, is when do you try new material? Mm. Okay, and to me, these are the extremes, you know, and most people are somewhere between them. But the absolute extreme is, this is a great audience. What a brilliant audience. I'm going to give them the best stuff that I know, which is my well-honed 20 minutes. This is a terrible audience. Got the one thing that's going to get them is my well-honed 20 minutes, because I know that works, and I can, if that doesn't work, at least I'm not walking away from here going, well, it was me.
Yeah.
Other end of the scale, this is the best audience I've ever had. What a brilliant time to try new material.
Of course.
Or this is the worst audience I've ever had. Well, sod it. I might as well try the new stuff now. If I'm going to go down the pan, at least I can have this. At least I can have this as a testing ground and just see while I'm saying it whether something extra comes into it. And
sure.
So I'm the first one. I am. Well, I'll stick with the act. You know, I'll write these other bits, and occasionally I was, you know, put a bit in here and a bit in there. But basically, overall, I am quite happy, you know, piling out the same old crap. Now, that potentially is why I lost the passion for it, or, you know, got bored with it or whatever, or, you know, suddenly driving 3 hours to do exactly the same thing isn't the same as driving 3 hours to
work on your exciting
new bit. To try a new line.
Yeah. And you made me want to draw a sort of XY axis now and present it to all comedians.
No, absolutely.
I interview and say,
well,
where are you?
Yeah. But that's the sort of, it's all those things that once you actually get aware of, then all the other crap sort of disappears, because you just go, well, that's okay. That's what I am. Mm. So there's no point in worrying about what these other people are.
Mm.
Because it's so insular, the comedy world and the magic world and the performing world generally, that it's very difficult not to get sucked into other people's, oh, this is what you should be doing, and why aren't you, you know, you get to be, why aren't you on why aren't you doing any TV? You go, well, I don't want to do any TV. You go, oh, all right, okay, like that, you know, but it's very difficult not to get drawn into those things, unless you're so aware, so you know, stuff like that, stuff on your... why you're doing it and what your views are towards success and stuff like that, what your views are towards, you know, material and writing stuff and doing new stuff, and whether you've got, you know, I I know generally, not outside, just in the comedy field, but I know generally I've got, and I never know which way around it is, whether I've got a high boredom threshold or a low boredom threshold.
Yes.
I can quite easily do sod all for a long, long time. Yeah. I'm not one of those people that needs to be doing new things. And I've worked with people who are like that, who are just like, oh, I'm in scuba diving now. And then it's 3 weeks on that, and they've sort of really got into it, and they've done all the reading on it, and they can. Now it's, I'm into chess.
Yeah.
And you just go, okay, you're one of those people that's like, you know, doing lots of things and getting really good at them, or just doing lots of things and not being good at them. But I don't need that.
Just as a, and we can, this can be a final thing if you're, we've spoken for a while.
I've got nothing to do for the rest of today.
I'm going to leave that in. I'm interested in you said before that you've not written, you said in your email to me earlier on, you know, you've not written anything new for a long time for the stand-up.
Right.
When you were writing, when you were making stand-up, when you were blazing a trail and excited by the challenge and all those sort of things, did you have a writing process?
No.
Did you write things down?
Yes, I'd write notes down and ideas down and stuff like that. And the main time, I guess, I was writing for the stand-up was when I... Because you wrote and you said, would you be happy to do the podcast? And I said, yes, delighted. And you said, oh, well, you know, I'll interview where you normally write.
Yes.
Could I interview where you normally write? And I said, I sold that house 15 years ago.
Yes, that was a lovely gag.
It does sort of sum it up, but... I was comparing it at two local clubs regularly, and you'd go, well, it's the same audience turning up each week, so I'm meant to write different stuff. And years and years and years ago, when I was street performing, I had no concept of even doing stand-up. For some weird reason, I got booked at Frank Skinner's club when he was in Birmingham. I mean, pre-everything, pre-Perrier and everything. And sort of that was the only stand-up I'd seen, and I think we did two different clubs in Birmingham for two nights, and then came down to Bristol and did the Fleece and Firkin in Bristol. Or maybe that was a separate thing. But I'd sort of seen him and thought, well, he's obviously writing all this stuff each week because you know, it was very much the Frank Skinner show. It was very much the they were there to see Frank because he was phenomenal and stuff like that. And, oh, here, I've got a couple of acts now and stuff like that. So it was definitely, it's a regular audience. It's not that, it was a different audience and you're just doing the same stuff each week. So I sort of assume that's what you sort of did as a compare. So I was writing stuff and doing that thing of, you know, a couple of topical things from the local paper and a couple of things in the paper and a couple of things that you just sort of thought about generally. And that sort of bits of it were... cut out of there and when I started doing so that was the other thing I was aware of. And again, this is going back years when there wasn't the number of acts that there are now. I was very aware of the, at that time, Hackney Empire New Act of the Year and Ha Bloody Ha New Act of the Year. Those were the sort of two London big London competitions. So my theory was and you know, again, because I'd had the street performing thing before that, my performing skills were up in that I was happy in front of being an audience had, you know, lines and bits and knew how to work an audience and stuff like that. So I was aware that I was sort of above the game where I should be for the amount of time that I've been doing stand-up. But I thought, what I'm going to do, I'm going to stay out of London, I'm going to do all this stuff that I can out of London, then go in, do these two competitions. Good because strategy. I thought I don't want to be seen. I went up and did a couple of open mic spots here and there. Just to sort of see clubs in London and stuff like that, but I was very aware from seeing open spots within the club in Bristol and Bath. You'd see people coming back, getting incrementally better.
Well spotted.
And the promoter and the promoter would never see when they'd got to the stage where you go, actually, now I can book them, because what they'd seen was you just getting better over a length of time, and they still remembered that first time when you came on, and you were. When I'm saying you, and I'm looking at you, I don't mean you. But, you know, when that person was crap. So my thing was like, right, okay, I don't want to go up to London and see to be getting incrementally better. I want to go in and be like, oh, right, where's he come from? So that was sort of part of the strategy.
Where has he come from is a really powerful weapon.
Yes. It doesn't last for long. I have to say.
No. But also, and the way you describe it as part of the strategy, having a strategy, I mean, that's a bonus to begin with, isn't it? When I started, I didn't have a strategy. I just thought, oh God, I want to do, I'll do stuff. I'm here, I'll do things. And actually, you see people increasingly now, I think, who've got, this is the plan.
Yes.
And they seem empowered by it.
Yes.
They seem powerful because of it.
Yeah. And again, as long as it is your plan and it's built on what you think is what your mindset is and stuff like that, you know, I think the problem is a lot of people have plans that are
based on no research.
based on no research, or even based on old research. And to my, you know, to the extent mine was as well, because I went in for Hackney Empire New Act of the Year and Hard Bloody Heart New Act of the Year. I think either the year that or the year after, suddenly, So You Think You're Funny and all the Edinburgh competitions actually became, that was the one that all the people were watching. You know, I mean, winning Hackney and High Bloody Hell were great because I could ring all the London clubs and go, and if you ever talk to Steve Jameson, he'll tell you what, he rang me up and he said, I won the award. Are you going to book me? You like that?
Really?
He's going, well, Steve, what else could I say? I was going, well, no, but I just thought a bit cocky and then, you know. Then you came along, oh, yeah, okay, well, yeah, right, it was justified, I suppose. So yes, I mean, I was that, you know, I had the right strategy but the wrong competitions and stuff like that. So in the same way that I still think people, there is part of me that goes, and like I said, I've only done Edinburgh once because it's the busy time for the walk and stuff like that. But there's a mentality, I think, of people going to Edinburgh because, oh, that's what you do, because that's what Frank Skinner did and the Perrier thing and all that, you know, that's, and you're going, yeah, but actually that's gone now. There's all these different ways that you could be doing things and people are still using...
Yes, Frank Skinner, when he went, wasn't competing in a marketplace where everyone knew that Frank Skinner had gone up there and been successful and that's how it's done.
Yeah. You know, and now people go, oh, well, that's the path that you take to do that thing. And you go, well, no, actually, there are all these other, you know, and people have clicked into them with YouTube and, you know, social networking and all that sort of side of it. We go, actually, well, now maybe that's way more important than taking a show up to Edinburgh for a couple of years or whatever. Sure. So, yes, I mean, if you've got a strategy, you've got to make sure it's up to date. I did a support slot for Lee Mack on two of his tours, and you know, Lee is one of those people that he's doing 120 dates in his tour or whatever. Yeah. And he said after 30, I was going absolutely. Well, I've said all this stuff now, haven't I? I've got to say it 90 times again now, and you know, and he's one of those people that is like, you know, prolific and is a very good writer and writes good stuff and writes it quickly and well and. Yeah. You know, and phenomenally for stand-up and for the sitcom, sure. And is a good improviser and all those things, you know. But he was, I just can't, you know, that was, you know, his boredom threshold is really low and mine is like, you know, well, yeah, I've been saying this for 15 years and I'm still, you know, I'm not, bored's not the right word with it, you know, sort of going, it's, you know, I'm still tweaking bits here and there and that bit of a longer pause there and stuff like that. And that goes back to Billy and George, and that's what they did. They honed their act for years and years and years to make it as tight as possible. And you said right at the beginning of the interview, you go, oh, you don't know how many, you know, you said you didn't know how many lines I had in my head for what happens and stuff like that. Sure. My other thing with it is I always think slightly of an act like a tree, in that you start off on this spot, you set off, and then you've got those questions that you can ask.
Yeah.
And you sort of know the reply is going to be this, or, you know, it could be a yes or no answer, or it could be, you know, where are you from? And that could be a different country, or it could be a different part of England. Well, each one of those branches off to a different line and a different thought or a different gag or whatever. And although you've got that starting point, by the time you've done all those little divisions, the end point could be any one of those ones at the top of the top of the tree.
I see what you mean, yeah.
So, and I think that's why I feel that, and I don't know whether it is, I mean, you know, when people come on the walk, the first, if they're performers that I know and acts that I know, the first two things I say is, could you see everything? Could you hear everything? That's the first thing. Could you see everything? Could you hear everything? And then the third thing was, does it sound like I've said it a million times before, or does it still sound fresh?
Right.
And people say, you know, people that, you know, I respect, but they might be saying it because they think that's what I want to hear. Go, you know, you're so good at making things sound fresh.
As if you just thought of
it. As if you just thought of it, and it hasn't, you haven't said it millions of times before. And if you've got that, if that's your speciality or your shtick or your, one of your, you know, one of your the tools in your box, then you go, well, actually, I can now, you know, that doesn't worry me so much that I've said it millions of times before, because to them it doesn't sound like I have. And to most of the people on the walk, I know that they're only going to see it once because it's a tourist attraction in a tourist town, and it's not something they're coming back to see time and time again.
Sure.
You know, in the same way with the stand-up, you know, one of the things I was very aware of, although I did, like I said, a couple of tiny TV things, it was that thing of, if you go on TV, that's that material sort of blown.
Would you ever be interested?
If you've got 2 million people watching it, I would prefer to spend a career
performing
to 300 a time.
Would you, if someone came to you now and said, we'd like to tape your act and sell it as a DVD or something like that, or put it on TV, given that you've, you know, notionally retired.
Right.
Would you be interested? I'm not quite sure what I'm asking. I'm just like, hypothetically, if all of your stuff got burnt.
Right.
And you were remunerated for that.
Yeah.
Would you be interested in starting from scratch? Could you ever see yourself doing a Seinfeld, like in his documentary Comedian, where he burns all his stuff and he goes out from scratch, plays the clubs, does the open spot stuff? Would you, is there a part of you still that would go, God, could I do that? You know, do you feel like you could write another hour? Presumably you've got the confidence in your material and your ability.
I think I could. The reason I wouldn't is because the only way that I can envisage that stuff is doing it at the comedy club circuit, and I wouldn't want to do that.
The process, it would take time for it to build up and be tweaked.
I just don't want to do the circuit. I don't really want that sort of... That's gone now.
Yes.
I suppose an example would be... I mean, touring with Lee was phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, that's great. You're working big theatres, you know, in lovely circumstances with people that have gone out to see a good time. I mean, the only slight drawback is... They're there to see Lee and, oh, shit, we've got to sit through this guy for half an hour, first of all. So there's an element of, you know, you've got to get through that, first of all. So, yeah, so touring with Lee was great. Now, Lee writes, you know, new hour each time he goes out on tour. I did three tours, one of his very first tours when he went out, which was this very, you know, small one, and then a bit of the last one. Now, if he said to me, I'm thinking of going out on tour again, would you write, I can't have you doing the same stuff because you came out on tour with me last time. I'm writing a whole new hour.
Yeah.
The least you can do,
the least you can do
is try and write a new 20 minutes. Would you be prepared to do that?
Yeah.
That I would do.
Okay.
And I think I could do it.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, apart from anything, I mean, I've got an hour and a half material that I do on the ships. You know, I mean, I do 3 half-hour slots on the ships. I mean, probably 15, 20 minutes of it is ship-based stuff, where unless the whole theatre is rocking, it's not going to make any sense whatsoever.
What about that buffet?
Yes, no? And my very amusing drop the anchor heckle line. That would all go. But if he said that to me, I would probably do. I'd be prepared to do that, yeah. But whether he would or not, I don't know. You know, I don't know whether he'd go, oh, I want someone different each time I go out there and stuff like that, you know. I mean, he's always said to me, oh, the great thing about you as a support act, this comes down to, you know, what different people want from different performers and different things. He said, I know you're going to do exactly the same thing every night.
Yes.
I know you're going to be pretty much word for word the same. You've got your little bits where you have a yes or a no, and you've got a different line, or, you know, this happens and you say that, and that happens and you say that. He said, but overall, he said, I don't have to listen to you while you're doing it. maybe that was the end of it. I don't have to listen to you. I don't have to listen to you while you're on. Just in case something comes up. Yeah. And so he liked that. He liked the fact that I'm static and I just stand at the mic and I don't move at all. And he's very frenetic and he moves around stage. He likes the fact that I'm southern and he's northern. You know, so I mean, it's there's a contrast.
Sure.
But he said, you're dependable and stuff like that. And, and again, there's that thing of, I did a street festival years ago with Chris Lynham, Chris the Piss.
Yeah.
Now, Chris, for those who don't know him, is one of those acts that will either take
100%
absolutely, absolutely guarantee to either take the roof off the place or walk off to the sound of his own footsteps. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no, I don't think there's sort of middle ground with him, really. Mm. I don't think he walks off stage and goes, what do you think of him? Yeah, he's all right. Yeah. I mean, you can't say that about him. No. You know, so he's got this huge sort of roller coaster of, and like I say, when he hits it and they're into it and he's on and it's, you go, God, you've never seen anything like this. This is absolutely phenomenal. Mm. And when it goes the other way, it's still very watchable for all the wrong reasons as a performer. So I was doing, I was doing this street festival and he was doing this huge, it was in Holland. And I mean, literally, and this is where on the street he was stripping down naked, sticking his cock between his legs, sticking a firework up his ass, and singing "There's No Business Like Show Business."
Yeah.
And he was doing that on the street in the street festival in fairly Catholic towns on a Sunday, and the car would be at the back of the pitch with the engine revving, and he would literally some shows just run, dive into the car, and they'd just like screech out because like we're going to have you if you know. If you even think you're going to be signing autographs after this when you've got another thing coming. But at the same time, he had these amazing shows with huge crowds where, I mean, you know, audience just literally, you know, hysterics, wiping away tears and stuff. And I was going through on my fairly sort of bland street before me, you know, I'm not offending anyone and, you know, much more of a, I was going to say flatline, but that's always the wrong term. a much more gentle...
Flatter line.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. It's got to be a gentle rip on it. If it's just flat, then you're in trouble. But there was my gentle ripple as opposed to his sort of, you know, huge tidal waves. And at the end of that festival, they booked Chris the following year, before the festival had even finished. You know, we want you back next year and stuff like that. You know, and you go, well, that's... And that's those are the sort of... cult comedians when they do stuff like that until they get such a big audience that actually you've got enough people within that cult to then become
that
a viable alternative audience.
Yes, splitting the room or rather like smashing it one night and dying the next means that after 100 gigs 50 people thought you were the best thing they've ever seen.
And as long as they then turn up,
rooms full of people.
So all those sort of, you know, and people said that. I mean, I worked with Harry Hill once when he was on the circuit. And he, you know, did phenomenally that night. But I've heard these stories where he was just like, you know, before he was known, people just going, well, what, you know, saying beds over and over again for 5 minutes. What's that all about? What is, you know? So, but if you get enough people who get it, then that becomes its own viable audience.
And it seems, coming back to your own career, it seems like you've made a virtue out of all of, like you really played the thing by your rules. You've made a virtue out of the things you like. You know, if you're doing tour support for Lee Mack and you're happy to be doing the same thing and you've happily found your niche and occupied it and made a great life out of it and now are very happy and have completed it.
Yes, yeah. Yeah,
good on you. That's incredible. Yeah. I mean, well done, mate. Yeah. Do you know how many unhappy comedians there are out there?
Should be a lot happier than I am. Aren't I? Thank God my wife's not here. You call this happy?
So there we go, ladies and gentlemen. Remember, you can go to comedianscomedian.com/Noel, that's N-O-E-L, for extra material about cruise ship gigs, the bell curve of fame and some thoughts on that. And we're going to talk through some very well-known gags of Noel's and the origin of those, how they came from, how he worked them in over the years, how they came from improvisation or ideas to being part of a set honed over 15 years. And there's also quite a lot more information about the walk and indeed Noel's love of orangutans that I couldn't actually fit onto the main podcast, but all fascinating stuff nonetheless. Thanks, as always, to Toby Rose for tech support, to Tom Wateracre and Graham Crockford for their technical support as well. Thanks to 2Entertain for their help and support. And that'll do me, I think. Next one's coming out soon. I think it's going to be Fred McCauley next week. That's the other big news, is that hopefully I'm going to start chucking these out one a week. So fingers crossed, and I'll speak to you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.